Okay. Hello, everyone. This is Mr. Chawla from the Virtual Voices podcast from Peel Virtual Secondary School. I know I say this every episode, but this is a very special episode. This is the first time we have a staff member and a student at the same time on the podcast. We have a grade 11 student named Sam. Sam, nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And we have Mr. Scott Tremblay, one of our talented teachers in our science and next year special education program. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how's it going?
So today we have our topic is really on neurodiversity. And in speaking to Sam and speaking to Mr. Tremblay, we noticed that there was some pretty significant overlap in both of your journeys through education. Sam, of course, is navigating through their educational journey right now, and Scott kind of came out on the other side, then came back. So I have a few questions for both of you, and then a few questions specific to Sam and then specific to Mr. Tremblay. So why don't we just get into it? Sam, we'll start with you. This is a question for both of you. Sam, actually, maybe before the first question, who are you? Where did you come from? And where are you right now? We'll start with introductions. How about that?
Okay, so I'm Sam, and I am I'm an advocate for neurodiversity, student leadership. I try to take any opportunity that I can within PVSS and just in my home community as well in Streetsville. Yeah, I'm just excited to be able to talk about this, something that I'm very passionate about, and wanting to give some details to people that are neurotypical in the education community of PVSS, and also for the neurodivergent people as well, both students, teachers, and staff.
That's great. I should also mention Sam had reached out specifically wanting to kind of talk about this topic, and that's kind of where this came from. So thank you, Sam, for reaching out and being an advocate. Mr. Tremblay, how about you? Where did you come from? Where are you and where you're going?
So my name's Scott. I think grew up in Toronto, born in Quebec City, grew up in Toronto, and went to, you know, university. I went to teachers college in 2006, if that can kind of date me for how long I've been within education. Started off as an Indigenous educator, kind of coordinating the spec ed program on Sandy Lake First Nations, and then I've been a Peel employee since 2010, working both in spec ed, student success, guidance, science, a whole bunch of different hats that I've worn.
It's good to hear. So let's get into it. So Sam, how about we start with you?
Okay.
What does neurodiversity mean? And specifically, what does it mean to you?
Neurodiversity to me is, well, in general, it's a spectrum. Whether you're talking about a specific diagnosis, specific labels, neurodiversity is a spectrum and everyone has their own unique experiences for it. For me, I've just been recently diagnosed. So growing up, I never had that feeling of being neurodiverse from in like a recognized neurodiverse student. So recognizing my younger self and myself now has definitely helped in like my education journey and to keep going forward. And it's something that definitely comes with its struggles. There's definitely some things from a personal level that I've struggled with, you know, just learning differently and expressing myself differently and needing the accommodations from school. But there's also some like systemic barriers that have definitely worsened my struggles with that. But I also believe that neurodiversity is something special because you think differently than others, and if everybody was the same, then the world would be so boring. So we definitely need to honor neurodiversity the same way that we honor neurotypical.
Beautifully put.
Yeah.
Let's see, Mr. Tremblay, what do you think?
I'm not going to repeat what Sam says, because I think Sam said it quite well. The only thing I would add in is that, like, within society and education, there's sort of this balance of what is quote unquote normal or typical. And to me, all neurodiversity means is that you exist outside those bounds. It could be above, below, to the left, to the right. And that if there's this kind of normalized path that people follow for getting educated or fit into society, neurodiversity is just like a winding road or a path that had speed bumps, something that has, barriers or a different sort of way to interact with it. And to me, that's sort of what neurodiversity is just there's this, in education, we want to create a system that's robust and can help the most amount of people the most efficiently, but that doesn't help everybody. And just neurodiversity or is just what fits outside of that or something that needs some of these barriers or pathways kind of clarified to make it work.
Absolutely. It can't be a kind of a catch-all. Next, maybe more specific to this podcast and its purpose, could you both share a little bit about your educational journey with neurodiversity? And Sam, why don't we start with you?
So as I said before, I've been just recently diagnosed. So my grade 11 year was the first year that I've had where I was specifically diagnosed with autism and ADHD. So when I was younger in elementary school, I was always looked at as like the student that was getting like 90s, like, and the A plus student, and I didn't cause any problems. And whenever my parents would have like meetings with the teacher, they'd be like, "Oh yeah, Sam's amazing. They don't cause any problems for us. They're not a rowdy student." And then, middle school hit, and I could start seeing a bit of like a struggle with personal issues with like friendships and stuff like that. And then that reflected on my educational journey as well. COVID hit in my grade 8 year. So going into that, was able to have a break from school for once, and then trying to go back into it, I realized that I was burnt out from all of that, all of elementary school. So then high school was just really difficult in my grade 9 year and grade 10 year. But then getting that diagnosis and knowing that like I can actually have these accommodations was something that was really impactful for me, because it I was able to say like, yeah, there's a reason why I'm struggling, and there's also ways that I can help with that, just like recognizing what I needed to, like what I needed to be helped with.
Sam, just before you go on, just for some listeners that may not know, you mentioned the word accommodations or being accommodated. What does that mean in your world?
For me personally, it means just having that understanding with, I know the whole term of like normalizing these like neurodivergency, so making it seem that like it, since it is a part of our society, making it so that there's no barriers to just live your life how you want to live it. So be having accommodations is just having that understanding to go up to a teacher or go up to somebody else and be like, yeah, I need to, maybe I need to write an essay, but I want it to be an oral presentation instead of it being a full-on written essay. And then having that space to show my learning in the best way possible. However, accommodations in the educational system, since there are barriers in it, it's definitely come across as just extra time. I know there's a lot of other neurodivergent students and some neurodivergent teachers as well who know. I see Mr. Tremblay, he's shaking his head, so he understands. It's definitely come across as accommodations as just extra time, and you get an the time and a half on exams, and it's like, sometimes you don't just need that. The extra time is great and having extensions is great, but it's also just normalizing that it's not just the fact that we need extra time. It's also we need to learn differently, and we need other resources that aren't just textbook.
Interesting. Now, the listeners can't see this, but Mr. Tremblay is about to explode right now. I'm sure he has a lot to say. So the original question was, Can you share a bit about your educational journey with neurodiversity and anything you want to maybe add to from Sam's response, Mr. Shrumley?
Yeah, maybe I'll just give a bit of my history. And I'm laughing because I've had the pleasure of teaching Sam. And none of these things came up in our course, but I mean, we could talk a bit about that later in the answer. So I had to call my mom and ask her about this stuff. And if you've ever met my mom, hi, mom, hopefully you're listening. You know, you're a force of nature. Love you. And where my journey starts is we moved from Quebec when I was a few months old. And upon arriving to Toronto, I got meningitis. I think it was the bacterial B version. And I was allergic to the medication, so they basically just had to let my brain cook until it went away. I'd lost the ability to hear when I was like 2.5, 3 months old. And I didn't gain the full ability to understand language. My mom says just before I started kindergarten. So I went through from age basically 2 to age close to 4 without the ability to hear. I was functionally deaf for all intents and purposes. And I know the whole cohort of other kids that went through the same thing as I did. I think it was about 10 or 12. This was through SickKids. We went through all our speech and language therapy and stuff at that age. And in fact, I continued with SLP support up until maybe I was 10 or 12. I was the only one that gained the ability to hear back. And it's because I was so young. I guess my brain was still plastic and it was able to adjust, right? So originally when I started struggling with stuff in school language, I thought it was just a delay because I couldn't hear. Like, you know, hearing is a big part of acquiring language. And of course, it was coming back incrementally, so they didn't feel they needed to have me learn how to sign because they were hopeful that it would all return. Then in grade 3 or 4, these issues started kept on persisting, even though I had full hearing back and my verbal language was catching up. So they tested me, and it turned out that I was one of the first people in the Catholic board in Toronto to be double identified. So they originally tested me for an LD, but the person assessing, I remember her name, Kat Mansouris, that was her last name, she decided to test me for giftedness as well, and they found that both were present. And so I was a language-delayed person because of hearing impairments, and I was also double ID'd as gifted NLD, and, you know, you'd throw on top of there a nice heavy dose of ADHD. That was sort of what I was dealing with, and this is back in the early 80s. And so really the system wasn't equipped to help me. I was the profile of student that usually would just timed out of the system and dropped out and never gotten through. But like I said, my mom's a force of nature, and we could talk about that another day. So early on, I was like, my identification and my neurodiversity has been built into me since before I could remember. I don't have many memories pre being diagnosed, and I definitely don't remember before I lost my hearing because I was 2 months old. And so that's sort of my journey with neurodiversity. It's been something that is just intrinsic to me. Like, I've normalized it for myself. You know, this was a label that whenever anybody gave me a label, I'm like, yeah, no kidding, right? Like, this is my life. So going through the system, it wasn't really until about grade 7 that I started getting bona fide support from someone that knew how to really support me in school. And that was Miss Paulina Effer, who even to this day I'm still in contact with. And that was, what, 35 years ago? I'm still in contact with her. Right. So any teacher that's listening, wondering if your efforts make a difference. I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but I can tell you it did for me. You know, Ms. Paulina for Ms. Stratford in high school, Mr. Broman, Mr. Paolini. Right. Like, I had all these wonderful teachers along the way that really helped me understand that I did fit in the system, and I was able to push back against those that maybe didn't do such of a successful job. But, you know, that's sort of my thing with education. I think we talk a little bit more later about some of the barriers, and I'll talk about it as perspective from a teacher, but that sort of was my journey. And I was one of the case studies they used for, you know, helping to develop spec ed policy in the Toronto board, the Catholic board specifically, because they didn't know how to deal with me. And arguably some people still don't know how to deal with me, but, you know,
it's Mr.
Chawla.
as I'm here, no, please don't do that to me, Mr. Chawla.
No, the best way possible, right?
It's interesting, you know, as I'm listening, I'm sure Sam would agree, you know, Scott, when we hear you talk about almost the meandering nature of your pathway, right? How it wasn't a straight shot, you know, something resolution. There were all these kind of navigating all these different competing interests. We'll get into it a little later on, but thank you both for sharing.
Yeah.
The last
one. So if I can add one more thing, I will. I'm just going to put this out because this is something I say to students in my class all the time. I failed my way through school. There wasn't the first time I passed English on my own. First time was in grade 10 English with Mr. Paolini. I was that student that every year they'd have to talk about whether or not they should move me from grade 3 to 4 or 4 to 5. And I was just so good at other subjects that weren't language based that they're like, no, this kid can catch up. And really, I think in terms of reading, well, not reading, I was always good at reading, but in terms of writing and expressive language, it didn't really catch up until grade 12. And the first time I successfully wrote things at my own level was actually when I was in university. And wow. So I was really a late bloomer. Like, it took me that long to catch up from that 3-year delay as a kid. So for those of you that are, you know, if you see that brilliance in a kid, it's there. Eventually it will hit. Eventually it will come out. And you just got to keep giving them opportunities to grow, because there was a lot of opportunities that, you know, it was a struggle to get. But again, thanks, Mom.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, all roads lead back to Mom. Yeah. And, you know, the next question here for both of you, it kind of touches upon things that I think both of you have been kind of dancing around for the past couple of questions. What are some common misconceptions about neurodiversity that you've encountered? And perhaps most importantly, how have you addressed them? I'm going to leave this up in the air. Sam, Scott, who wants it first?
I can go first if you want.
Yeah, Sam, please.
Sure.
So I didn't have a diagnosis until last year. So I remember I was so funny though, because I was always the student that was put with the neurodivergent kids, because I would finish my work early and they would be like, yeah, you can go help them. So I was like, okay, yeah. So I always sat with them, and we always my best friends were always people that always had like the support teacher with them. And I just remember my first time with my first experience with that misconception of a neurodivergent student was in the computer lab in grade 6. There was somebody that was trying to do like this like quiz that we were doing, and this teacher was yelling at him because he wasn't understanding things, and she was like saying to like hurry up. And I'm sitting there and I was like listening to this teacher yell at this kid, and I was like, but he's just like me, you know? Like, if he has to take his time, like, aren't you the teacher that's supposed to be supporting him? So I didn't, since I was in grade 6, I didn't feel, like, I had that same thing of, like, you know, I didn't want to disrespect the teacher, right? So I didn't speak up or anything. But I remember going home and being like, you know, from this point on, I'm going to speak up if anything happens again. And this is where it led me today, of where I want to become a teacher, to be that teacher that doesn't yell at those kids and can tell other teachers not to yell at those kids, right? And like, even too with like the misconceptions that like I've had, I know specifically with me, there's a lot of terminology that has been used in like the past years of like, I know like high functioning, low functioning autism. So we don't use it anymore. We use, I know when I was diagnosed, we use more levels. So like I was diagnosed with level 1 autism. And I feel like when people say like, oh, you're diagnosed with level 1 autism. Oh, so that means that, you know, you're like easy to deal with. And it's like, oh, okay, so I'm not like the other kid over here that's exactly like me and thinks the same way as me, but just because they can't speak to you, and it's because you have to do a little bit more, they are hard to deal with, but I'm easy to deal with. And it's like, you know, I remember when I got diagnosed with level 1 autism, I was like, well, to me, it feels like you're not looking at the struggles I have. It's like, oh, because you're level 1 autism, you don't have all these struggles that somebody with level 2 autism have. And it's like, but I still have those struggles, except I'm able to, I know a lot of neurodivergent people mask. So people that are like me who fit more, in quotations, fit more into society, we've been able to mask things. So when people finally see that we're unmasking, they're so shocked, right? And it's like, you know, just because somebody has level one autism or might be easier to deal with, that they don't struggle. And that's like, and like how I've been addressing them is just by trying to tell people and trying to keep like advocating for myself that, like, yeah, you know, I struggle the same way as any other person struggles that has autism. Just because I'm able to talk, I'm able to formulate my thoughts in a way that people will understand, doesn't mean that I don't struggle.
Sam, you mentioned the word masking or the behavior of masking. What is that?
It's, if you think of, like, for example, like an actual mask, you know, when you put on a mask, it hides who you are underneath the mask, and you can put any mask on. It can be like a stormtrooper mask, it can be like a very fancy frilly mask, you know, whatever it is. So when it comes to neurodivergency, my experience with masking, I actually only masked recently, in like the past like couple years, because growing older I was like, oh, people don't accept me how I was when I was younger, so now I have to be different. So that was my thought with masking. So it's basically trying to fit into society when society doesn't accept you for who you are. So things like stimming for autistic people, you try to reduce that. You know, rambling on about a certain topic, you try to reduce that. And it's just reducing all these tendencies that you have to do. It even goes in like wearing certain clothes to fit in and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think to be yourself may not be reasonable, so you take on something else. Mr. Tremblay, I'm very interested to know what you think. Some common misconceptions or anything Sam had mentioned that you may want to
Yeah, I
respond.
think Sam just caused me to do a 180 on what I was going to say, because like this whole issue of masking is very interesting. I think we've talked about this before, just casually or colloquially. People don't see me and automatically assume neurodiversity. People don't see me and know that I was, you know, deaf for the first little bit of my life. They don't see all that, and it's very easy for me to hide it unless we get into specific situations. And it's one of those things where it's, I've only felt comfortable really putting myself out there and kind of wearing it as a just an identifier for me after I reached quite a lot of success in my life. By all measures, I'm successful, right? I mean, I managed to finish my education. I have a what I consider to be a pretty good job, one that suits me well. You know, I'm now in my mid-40s. I'm at the tail end of my career. I have more years behind me than left ahead of me for teaching. And so really when I go out and say, hey, I'm neurodiverse, I'm doing it as a way of saying I'm neurodiverse and you can be successful as well if you mean if you view what I am as successful, rather than I'm neurodiverse and then having people just pick you off. I can give you a few examples. Like when I was in grade 6 and 7, I had a teacher and I was a few years ahead of math. I was doing high school math in grade 6 and 7. Math was always my solace. You know, I couldn't fail spelling with numbers. I was never dyslexic with numbers. I was with letters. And she said that she couldn't give me above an 80 in math because I had a learning disability. Right. And it was like, but I'm doing math as 3 years ahead of your curriculum. Right. Or I had a teacher, a history teacher in grade 11 that was like, well, if you can't spell, you can't do history. Right. And I'm like, yeah, but I have an IEP in there that says, you know, you can't. She goes, doesn't matter. Are you spelling in history? If you can't get the word right, you can't do it. And so I dropped out of, stopped doing history. And if it wasn't for that, I still to this day contend that I wouldn't have gone into sciences. I probably would have went into history and social sciences, right? It's easy to hide those things. And it's, I think the thing about neurodiversity is it's not an issue of attitude, it's an issue of function. So like I'm in a interracial relationship. My mother-in-law, love her. I love you, Helena. You're awesome. But I had to really get to know her culture over about 10 years, and she had to get to know my culture over 10 years for us to fix our attitudes towards each other. And now that those attitudes are there and established and we understand each other, I'm going to go stay with her for the whole summer, and I'm looking forward to it, right? My mother-in-law, I love her. She's one of my favorite people on earth, even though we didn't start off so good for the first 10 years. we fixed that attitude towards each other. Our relationship is good. It's fixed. It's goodness and established, right? I think when you support someone, if you fix your attitude towards neurodivergency, it doesn't actually address the issue because there's still a functional component that needs to be supported through it, right? Much like you can support someone through that functional support, but not fix your attitude. So stuff like I've heard as a teacher, like, you know, we're sitting around staffing, and it's like, oh, man, I got like 10 kids in my class with IEPs. And it's like, so I got 10 kids in my class with it. And it's just an opportunity to, you know, have a good time, right? Like, I'm just going to accommodate the classroom. I'm going to use certain strategies that, you know, support everybody. Give them all to me. Come on, let's go, right? But it's just these malign sort of attitudes when it's the real work isn't the attitude. The real work is getting rid of those barriers, making it an easier road for them. And then a lot of the issues go away. And this is why to this day, I still say, like, I didn't know Sam was neurodiverse in my classroom, or nor did I think Sam ever really asked for, I mean, if Sam asked for something, I didn't identify it as being neurodiverse. I just identified it as good teaching, right? I think this is the thing we need to do is just, you got to get rid of the attitudes around ability. And you also got to understand that there is a functional background for why we're supporting is to make it so that it isn't equitable. We're trying to make it so neurodiversity isn't a barrier in the classroom rather than normalizing it in a lot of ways. There's just been, yeah. And that's sort of, I guess I'll leave it at that, but masks, so easy for me to hide. So easy for me to hide. And I did it for a long time. And I still do it in some situations, to be honest.
And as you're speaking, and you mentioned, you know, Sam being in your class briefly last year, it didn't dawn on you.
But
that Sam was neurodivergent.
I didn't.
And it's, no, it's interesting because Sam is Sam. Scott is Scott. Samir is Samir, first and foremost. Everything else that qualifies us and groups us together is part of the multitude that we are. So, you know, Scott, when you're mentioning that, it's this kind of a beautiful thing because you treat someone based on their needs. I mean, Sam, you mentioned a few times now, your diagnosis happened about a year ago. It begs a question. You didn't change before and after these words were attached to. You're still Sam. You know, so treating individuals as individuals is important. And that kind of leads me to my next stem of questions here. We're going to just separate them out between Sam and Scott, with the student and the educator experience. So Sam, we'll start with you. Question is, what strategies have you found effective in removing barriers in education that stem from your neurodiversity, especially when you're trying to balance your academics and everything else that comes along with being a teenager?
Oh, this is a very difficult question.
That's a good one.
Yeah, take your time.
Definitely still figuring out strategies. Just going to say that. Getting a diagnosis doesn't just give you a bunch of things. Trying to think here. Really just, I know Mr. Tremblay mentioned this, of normalizing yourself. Knowing that what you do isn't a negative thing. I know a lot of, I know there's actually been a lot of discussion about this, like on social media and stuff, where they said that when you go for a diagnosis, the symptoms that you say that you have are always ones that make you, that would make somebody difficult to deal with. So, for example, when it comes to ADHD, not being able to sit still, not being able to focus, not being able to do this and that. When it comes to autism, not being able to keep eye contact. I know nonverbal is another thing that is always something so, like, up in arms with everybody. And, you know, it's not only do you have to normalize yourself, it's also understanding that you have greatnesses as well. Like, these things are your strength as well. And even if, you know, sometimes when I do go nonverbal, it is difficult for me because it's like I really want to say my thoughts and ideas. Excuse me. But in stressful situations, sometimes that's not even possible for me, right? But then it's understanding that I do have a lot of other strengths as well. Like, I know Mr. Tremblay was talking about struggles in English, and that's exactly how I feel as well. English has always been more difficult for me. But then I remember it's like, okay, well, English might be really difficult for me, but things like science, history, and stuff are always something that I'm very strong at. And it's just having that mindset going through things really helps you with the education side. And then also knowing that, when it comes to identity, being a teenager, as you said, that the things that you like to do, so for example, with me, it's like art, music, and video games. It's okay to take a break from education for just like a couple of seconds because you spend so much of your life in school. And it's like if you want to just take a break and step back for a second, you can do that and do things that you like to do because at the end of the day, you can still get to where you want to get to if you take those breaks. Because, if I think back to myself in grade 9 or even in middle school, like I was very much somebody that like I was like, oh, I want to do this, this, and this, but school has always like been like, okay, I can do that later because that's easy for me, right? But then being able to be here now, and it's like, okay, even though I did take breaks back then, like I'm still here now. I'm still in grade 11 and doing good in grade 11, So like you can have these difficulties, have your likes and other activities that you want to do, and you can still continue academically and still shine where you want to shine,
I think both of us do know exactly what you mean, and it kind of feeds into the next question. And you may have already touched upon this a little bit when you're talking about your own mindset and how it's developed and evolved over time. Sam, do you have an experience or a moment where you felt particularly empowered as a neurodiverse individual? We do sometimes spend a lot of time talking about the differences between typical and atypical, or the vernacular changes over time. But I got to just let our listeners and Mr. Tremblay know, when Sam first reached out to do this podcast, we met and we had a colloquial discussion on what happened. And I always thought people with diagnosed neurodiversity had superpowers, and I still think it. So this is why I think this question is so important. Has there ever been a moment that you feel comfortable sharing where you felt empowered as a neurodiverse individual?
I feel like these questions and just like having a moment to like sit back and reflect on the times where you feel empowered is very important because society has really tried to just keep putting us down, as in like your struggles overthrow all of your empowered experiences, even though they are quite equal. Your struggles are equal to the times that you felt empowered as well, right? For me, there's a lot of little moments where, thinking back, it's like, just the simple thing of like, I can do this. Even though going into it, it's like, I can't do this. Like, who, like, imposter syndrome also plays heavily into this, where you don't feel like you belong. And you make it seem like you are an imposter in the situation. But specifically, it was probably last summer. I did the York University did a summer program for physics. So I was a junior lab assistant. So, excuse me. And basically, we had a research question. Mine was about climate change, and we were in a group. I think there was like maybe five other high school students in my group. And we learned the grade 11 physics course over that time, but in the afternoon portions of it, we also were using a research question and using what we learned over that time in physics to then create a prototype to solve our research question. So the research question was about how can we something about basically lowering and reducing the effects of climate change. So our solution was to make an eco-friendly house that reduces carbon emission. And I was in charge. We since we were all online, we all had our own kind of part of the house that we made. So my idea was a sink water turbine. So it would turn kinetic energy from the turbine spinning as the water went down the drain into electricity. And being able to create that prototype and say, like, this is what I've done over this month, and then being able to present it in front of university faculty members, like, these were people that had, like, PhDs, and, like, were, like, the person that gave us the research question, he came up to me and he was like, you should upsize this. He's like, I would be behind you to upsize this. This is an amazing product that you've made. And just hearing that, it sticks with me because it's like, wow, you know, even though this was like a month before I got diagnosed, I still knew that I had either autism or ADHD, in case it was both. And just knowing that the amount of misconceptions behind it, it's like, you know, we actually can do things, you know, like, I was able to create something that, even though I'm just a high school student, somebody with a PhD was able to come up to me and say, like, this is an amazing product and I will be behind you for this. Like, that was something that, like, you know, those, like, little moments, even these big moments, is something that you just, like, have, like, a jar of these memories so that whenever you feel like you're not doing things, you can just go back and be like, wow, this is so important that I was able to do something here.
Absolutely. And I'm so confident that in the next 20, 30 years, in a similar way to Mr. Tremblay talking about those formative teachers that he had in his educational career back in public school, remembers full name as if it was yesterday. Thank you, Sam. Mr. Tremblay, the kind of representing the educator portion of this conversation here. Yeah, I'm going to lump them both together. So,
yeah,
challenges that you've faced as a neurodiverse educator yourself. And secondly, when you were a teacher, what are some strategies that you implore to make your classroom as inclusive as possible?
Yeah, here we go. Right. I guess there's an internal struggle I've always had, which is part of my speech issue from when I was a kid, is I have an internal stutter. So I get stuck on words and see, like, I just do it right now. When I think about it, it happens. And so I typically talk really fast. And the reason I do that is, let me just power through the words to get them out. And then something else I do that I know I do, but I'm powerless to fix. I'll get stuck on something and people think I've stopped talking and that I've done ideas. And then it comes out 10 seconds later. And now people think I'm interrupting them. What that is actually, it took me a lot long to get the words out. Right now, I notice the longer I work with people, or the people that I work with that know I do this, they're like, oh, okay, you weren't done, I get it. A lot of people see that as being, like, either aggressive or these other things, but people that really know me, like, when I'm around my family, they're like, oh, okay, I guess you weren't done, cool. You know, and it's one of those things where it's like, I guess maybe I should explain it some more, or at least the people I work with, I'll be like, hey, like, online it's nice because I can just hit mute the mic and just talk to myself or type it in chat or something. But it's one of those weird little things that I've consistently been told over time. So when I teach, I try to format and structure my lessons a lot that I can slow down. So full stop, this was my biggest challenge when I started teaching, was just the pace. So talking to you casually here, I might just, like, you know, sometimes I get going and boom, I give you like a 500 word essay in about 4 seconds. But I think maybe Sam could confirm this, but I'm actually teaching stuff on the screen and stuff. I do slow down in a manageable pace and that it is quite clear and working, but I can otherwise seem quite spastic if we're just sitting here talking. The other end of it would be, I can give you three little stories quickly that sort of tell you about some educators I've interacted with that, not through any sort of malice, but just through attitude, kind of informed me how I should teach. One was a university professor. He was the best, I don't know, probably the best teacher I ever had, let alone professor, right? I'm not going to mention his name, but I mean, now he's quite high up in the education circles and just a wonderful, wonderful human being. And I was meeting with him to go through my transcript. I was trying to get into a master's program. He says, "Scott, I'm surprised you don't have more higher marks." Because in his class, I was getting in university 90s and all that stuff. And then my other marks were just like, okay, they weren't great. They were okay. And he was surprised. Right, because all he saw was me being this brilliant climate science student. It's ironic, you know, brilliant climate science student in physics. But then, when he looked at all those other credits, he's like, "Why did you know? Where's the struggle?" He didn't get it. Then when I went to teachers college, you know, we have to do our sessional course on special education. I'm sure you went through it as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sam, you'll find out one day you're gonna have to sit in a course and learn about spec ed stuff. And I mean, I had a degree in psychology where I did a lot of educational psychology stuff, but I sat through it. They wouldn't exempt me. Thank you, University of Windsor, but it was fine. And the topic came up of is, can anyone know what learning disabled is? Not learning disability, but learning disabled as a specific subset of communication disorders. And so I raised my hand and I gave this brilliant explanation, textbook definition. And she was like, "Well, how do you know this?" And I'm like, "Well, I have a degree in psychology, but I'm also LD myself." And then her response was, "Oh my gosh, you've done so well for yourself." And then my response, because I'm very quippy, was, "Well, was I supposed to fail?" And then just the blood drained from her face. And then it was the end of class. And I went down and said, "No, I'm not offended. I'm not going to try to cancel you. Like I know you're sitting here doing the good work," but that's really what it is. Because I think now as an educator, like 20 years later, almost 20 years later, I get it, because the vast majority of cases she interacted with, the system wasn't built for them. And so she saw a lot of failure in that. It was more of this joy of somebody that she worked with was now actually being successful. And then the last one, I was working with a teacher at a school that was also a educator, and said, "Well, don't you think we give too many IEPs, the individual education plans, the documents we use to support students?" And I'm like, "Well, why do you say that?" He goes, "Well, so many of these kids on IEPs are doing so well." And I'm like, "Isn't that the point?" I know, right? I'm like, isn't that the point? Isn't that the point, right? Like, so my joke, and I've always used it, and I guess maybe I can flex my neurodiverse card and say this, is my point is to make it so neurodiversity doesn't matter in a classroom. My point is to run spec ed teachers, myself being one of them, out of a job because we're just not needed. Now, the reality is that'll never happen, right? But that's the goal. And the goal is, and so as an educator, what do I do? Well, it's quite simple. I just look at all the barriers that are teacher created and I just get rid of them. If I find one, I nuke it, right? So stuff like extra time. Why should a student advocate for extra time? When did it ever hurt anybody? I mean, you get a student that doesn't know how to answer something on a test, sitting there for an hour and a half looking at it isn't going to help them. So why not just give it to them for the ones that need, so that they don't feel like they have to ask and advocate, right? Because like when you're sitting there always having to ask for it, you now feel like you're being given an advantage. Why not just, like, you want to level the playing field? Open up. There was a puzzle put in a public park in Chicago done by the School of Behavioral Economics, and had four quadrants, and one quadrant had five extra Lego pieces on it, and they gave people a bucket of pieces and said, "Make the whole puzzle equal. 95% or whatever the number is, I don't know what the number is, put five extra pieces." So they added 15 pieces in total to make it equal. Well, what are the really kind of gamey kind of people do, Mr. Chawla? Do you know what the solution is? Or Sam, do you know what the solution is? You don't add five to the other three, you take away five from the one, and now they're all the same, right? So it's like we have this intrinsic, as teachers, as helpers, we have this intrinsic built-in thing where we always want to add. Why don't we just subtract, right? I think winning through subtractions, remove the barriers. Right, a student struggles with writing. You can help them with writing, or you can give them alternate formats. And I always say to students, write it, and if your writing isn't good, speak it to me. If that isn't good, draw it. If that isn't good, well, let's find a way to do an interpretive dance. And they think I'm joking, but I'm not. I'm like serious. Like, I don't care. Just I want to know what you know. I don't care how you get it to me. It doesn't make a difference.
I love
And it
that
is.
you're saying that. Oh, sorry, I'll let you finish.
No, go ahead. It could be a conversation. It's fine.
I was gonna say it's interesting. It sparks my memory, and I Scott, I think I told you, but Sam, I don't think you've heard this story. I was teaching. I think it was a grade 9 or 10 science class, and I had a lot of students. It was an ELD class, which is students that are learning not only English but learning their own language, their own home language, and English at the same time. So I had 14-year-olds up to 19-year-olds and everyone in between with various levels of language. And we decided as a course team that we were going to do a whole bunch of activities during the week, and then we're going to come together at the end and students will write a reflection. It could be a paragraph, it could be a page, whatever you want to do it, but it will be in class. So that was on Friday. Thursday night, I sat down, made myself a big plate of pasta. That's my comfort food. and a student emailed me. It said, "Sir, I don't know why we're doing this in class." I said, "Well, what's the issue?" I can't really write that quickly. So why not have us just write it at home and I can bring it in? Like, why the time constraint? He was right. I had this moment. I lost my appetite for a second, thinking I was, you know, such a good teacher. Put the food down. I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, David's right. Came in the next morning, looked at everyone, said, "All right, everyone, give David a pat on the back because he definitely challenged me." You know, say where you were talking about challenging and kind of interrupting those behaviors. It works, because here I am, 15 years later, telling you the story, getting sparks from Mr. Tremblay's. So I appreciate that. I really hate to do this. We are kind of running out of time. We've got about 10 minutes left. There's kind of like a wide question that I wanted to ask both of you. And we've obviously been touching upon it during this entire recording. But how can neurotypical students and educators better understand and support their neurodiverse peers and students? And then there's some qualifiers underneath, but why don't we start with Scott?
Yeah, I'm going to take this on actually as a slightly different one. Like, I think earlier you said something to me that's been causing me to think for the last 10 minutes, where you said, you see, people that have neurodiversity is having a superpower. I think that's a fair attitude. And I mean, I guess it's empowering to me, and I view myself as being superpower, but everything that I'm capable at, it's tied to who I am as a person, where my neurodiversity is just an adjective that describes me. It's not the noun of who I am. Right. And so maybe if you properly, or I'm not saying you're not doing it, but maybe if the room is accommodated such where the neurodiversity has a room to live in a normalized manner, that you just see students as having superpowers, not neurodiverse students having superpowers. I think the reality because I think the reality is that, like, if I hadn't have, I'm a scrappy, persistent, argumentative human being who sometimes comes off as being aggressive and obnoxious. The reality is that I wouldn't have made it through the system if I hadn't been built that way. And there's so many other students that weren't built like me, or so many of my peers that weren't built like me, that never found a way through. Right. And so even at that, like, I'm not a normal experience for someone with the situation that I was in. I was one of the few that managed to find a way through. Luck of the draw, my mom, a couple of good teachers along the way. You remove any of those, nothing I could have done to change the course of it. Right. And so I think really what we've got to look at is, like, what talent are you losing in the room by not allowing those individuals or those people to live in the room, right? Mm-hmm. There are these superpowers you're losing out on because you want to have them defined by what they can't do. Even my diagnosis of learning disabled, you can only be learning disabled if you function at an average or above average level. There's nothing disabled about my learning. My learning is fine. My learning is tight. It's that communicating that stuff and using the tools that other people have is the problem. And so the problem is with them listening and the system that I work in, not with me and my own brain. Right. And that's something that's taken me 40 some odd years to really understand. Right. And so I like your concept of saying neurodiverse superpowers, but can't we just say people with superpowers? Because we just want to remove the whole neurodiversity from being part of it if we're properly accommodating. Quick little technical definition: an accommodation is anything a teacher can do for a student at any time for any reason. They don't need permission or prior consent. A modification is where you're changing the expectations. For me, an accommodation is something that's given and granted and doesn't have to be asked for. It doesn't need to be asked for. An accommodation, well, yeah, that's something that has to go through, you know, the whole process and page fours and all that stuff, right? Sure. So I'll just leave it at that. I think that's sort of the message, is, like, stop looking at these people as being different. If you're accommodating them, they're going to normalize and they're just going to be people in your room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. I like how that, like, fits with kind of the theme of this episode too. Sam, I mean, the listeners can't see this, but Sam is just, you know, nodding their head up and down.
Well,
that resonated with you too, Sam?
Well, it's part of the reason I never saw Sam's neurodiversity, right? Anyways,
Sam, yeah, resonates.
Definitely resonates with me. excuse me. One second.
Yeah, sure. Sure, take a time.
There we go. Sorry. That definitely resonates with me. Especially too, like how you said that you didn't notice my neurodiversity. I think that's, like, you know, for me, like, identity is something that, like, I hold very proudly. So, like, it doesn't really matter to me if people see me as being autistic. it's something that like whatever, right? But like knowing that like a teacher doesn't see that, but also has the mindset of, well, I didn't see it because you're perfect or you're easy to deal with. Like you just didn't see it because you don't have any of like the bad attitude towards it. That's what it should be. It shouldn't be you didn't notice it because I'm easy to deal with. It's you didn't notice it because we're all students and we're all different. We have different struggles. We have different skills. We have different strengths, different less strengths, you know, different things like that, right? And also too, like going back onto the question of like better understand support. I know something that over the past, well, I've been at PBSS since like the beginning, right? And something that I've always preached about was how accessibility is important. I find that PBSS has definitely been accessible to anybody with a disability. And this means like physical disabilities, what people call invisible disabilities, or anything like that. Like, you know, you take, for example, a club in school, like in person. And let's say you have to go upstairs for to get to that club's room. Somebody in a wheelchair would have to, it would be very difficult to get there. And that's the same thing about neurodivergency. Being in person is very stressful because you have the bright lights of a classroom. You have the sounds of everybody talking at the same time in a classroom. You have, you know, I, you know, with just sounds and stuff. Somebody might be like eating a snack or like ruffling a bag, and it's like, wow, that's like I can hear that 10 times louder than it is, even though that's at the back of the classroom. Or you know, you're sitting down in a chair that, you know, that's not the right chair that you always sit in for like all of school, right? It's now different to you. So being online, you know, I'm in my room right now, sitting down in a chair that I've made comfortable for me. You know, I don't have to have these bright lights in my face. You know, I have the comfortability of like, you know, being able to turn off my headphones, and adjust sound so that things aren't so loud, right? And then being able to go to these clubs, like I'm in so many different things right now. I've been like asked to do so many different opportunities, and like even just getting the opportunity to speak here, like if I was in person, I probably would have just been, okay, I'm gonna go into my classes and go home. That's all I want to do because I just want to go home, do my work, and then probably sleep because that was so overwhelming for me. So having that accessibility at PBSS of, you know, being able to be in the comfort and have my like being like with like the things that make me comfortable. And I know like other students too, you know, you're in a place where you're comfortable in and you can do so many different things without having to worry about things that might make you uncomfortable. That's like really important.
It's interesting because as you're speaking too, it seems like just so everyone knows it's April 29th, 2024. PBSS, Pediatric Secondary School, been open for just under 2 years. Very, very new. And as you're speaking, it's kind of dawning on me, even the existence of this place and this vehicle of learning online, morning classes, afternoon conferences. That in and of itself, the option in and of itself is a type of removal of barriers that may have been, well, may have caused you or other people in similar situations, a lot of headache and heartache. So I appreciate the insight, Sam.
Can I book in this? Yeah, I just want to book in this pretty good. Yeah,
absolutely.
so I think the one thing Sam mentioned at the beginning of the podcast was about masking, and I've known for quite a lot of people. PBSS is a vector for a lot of different reasons, and it's a beautifully easy place to mask as well. And so I just think the safety and security and the ability for people to really redefine the lesson of who and what they are is so important here. And a lot of people are seeking it out specifically for that. It could be neurodiversity, it could be maybe you have a medical condition, maybe you're in conflict with the law, maybe it's to do with gender identity, all these other things where you want to be a student functioning in the classroom. You don't want all that noise defining your sort of experience in school. And I think for a lot of people, this has been a really good respite for getting away from all that. And I know for me, having a quiet space because of the hearing problems I had in my life, like, it's brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And it's so cool to think that, you know, Scott Trombley, the teacher, can focus on being an educator and not have to deal with all that. And Sam can focus on being a student, not have to navigate that other stuff that gets in the way and prevents, you know, opportunities from being taken advantage of. So I appreciate that. With that, we are basically out of time. Last chance, Sam, Mr. Trombley, any last words for our listeners?
Not for me, just, you know, just the simple of understanding and the unconditional support. Excuse me.
I think for me, if you're struggling with any of these issues, there are others that are having similar struggles, and there's also those of us that have been through and came out on the other end. There's nothing wrong with you. You didn't do anything wrong. This is just, it's just part of who you are, and I love you for it. And feel free to reach out whenever you want, and we can always chat about it. There is a place for you, and if you haven't found it, well, let's help you find it. Okay.
Wonderful. Sam, Scott, thank you so much for your time and attention today. For everyone listening, this is the Virtual Voices Podcast. See you in the next one. Bye-bye.